Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and someone who could be said goes down a bit too easily, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Famously true.
Very Latin, aren't you, Nathan?
You've immediately made me think about the Latin comment and the retraction of that when it's like they say similar things. Like that is English punditry, is talking about the way Latin players go down easy. So why, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have retracted and apologised for that, but why that particular bit rather than literally everything else they say? Whatever, it's not important. Let's not leak with that.
I feel exactly the same. And there's going to be lots of fun in this podcast before anyone switches off. Before we do the fun bits, I just want to dedicate this podcast to a great man who I lost today, my girlfriend's dad. I mentioned a while back we were having some difficult times, and we lost him today. He was a wonderful man, Alan. I adored him. He was a huge Liverpool fan, and look, they won the title in his last year of being alive. So a great send off for a great man. Rest in peace, Alan. Next, a little announcement. So we're going to pass 400 ex-subs today, 400 patrons. Incredible. Thank you so much for all of your support and for all of the feedback we've had so far on all the additional content you're getting. We're delighted you're happy with it. We are very happy with it too. Yeah. What this means for us is that we can now pay Nathan for his production. So he's going to invoice me hopefully soon. Feel free to complain if there are any issues, because Nathan's now doing this professionally. we can now pay content providers and, you know, have a little bit of money left over to spread between us for the work we put into this podcast. So thank you so much. We're determined to keep the quality high in our free weekly pod. And of course, delivering behind the paywall as well. Boys, we beat Man U 6-1.
Smashed them.
Absolutely smashed them.
We've made Man United actually ponder what kind of football club they are. That's how big this defeat goes for them. That this has shaken them to the very foundations. They're unsure of who they are now. So that's the significance of this victory.
An existential thrashing.
Yeah, quite literally. They keep saying, "Oh, we've been beaten before," but they've never quite been beaten like this before.
I think what you're saying, Bardi, is that lads, it's Tottenham has taken on a whole new meaning.
Yeah, it's just everything has been shown up for lack of decisiveness on the pitch, off the pitch, in the boardroom, in the changing room, everything. And it's kind of, they've kind of hit a point where I know we like to talk in modern football about, oh my God, this is a crisis, but this is a serious failure of club ethics, club values, club everything. Everybody shares a part of this defeat at Man United. United. It doesn't go on Woodward or Solskjaer alone. It's spread across everybody. We've never seen that before at an institution like Man United.
I kind of want to say that they're a club at a crossroads, but I feel as though a club of that size is never really at a crossroads. They're just a couple of decisions away from being massive again and from being successful again, right?
They are
just throw another 100 million at this problem and it goes away pretty quick.
Mm. They're at the crossroads, and then Ndombele come charging past and shoulder barged them into the road, and they've been flattened.
Harry Maguire's massive fat head just flattened on the road under a 4x4.
Yeah, roadkill, man.
So let's start where we always do, team selection. I didn't feel great when I saw the team. I'm not going to lie about that. I did have a bit of a mini meltdown. Nathan, how did you feel when you saw Aurier and Sissoko in the starting 11?
Yeah, mixed. I guess we shouldn't be surprised. I guess we're doing an almost Pochettino-esque fullback rotation
now,
where we're doing the strong weak strong kind of vibe. Our first choice right back and our second choice left back. Our first choice left back and our second choice right back kind of thing. So I guess I've got to get used to that. But I mean, obviously, Aurier had a hell of a game. So I have to retract any issues I might have with him starting. Mm-hmm. Sissoko, you know, I don't mind him in the big games because I think that sort of suits his skill set, space to run into, combativeness, all of that kind of stuff. And hey, is it consecutive starts? I mean, maybe not consecutive starts from Ndombele, but like, I felt like him starting was like, okay, he is now a first 11 player.
Locked in. Thank God. Bardi, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was like you guys. I was very scared when I saw that lineup. I think we were helped out by Man United playing into the hands and into the skill set of Sissoko. Had they sat off us and then made Sissoko do stuff with the ball, we might have been trouble. But then again, he did spray the ball around quite nicely for Moussa Sissoko. So I was nervous, but Sonny was there. And when Sonny's in the starting lineup, you've always got that kind of counter-attacking punch. So I was happy and sad, but you know, at the end, it didn't really matter, did it?
I fucking knew when Mourinho immediately said Son's gone off and it's really bad, oh, he's going to be out for ages, that he was talking crap, because it was way too early for a scan. He walked off fine. He was playing up to the, oh, woe is me, everything is so bad, all my players are injured all the time. I didn't want to say, because I've had a bad recent history of talking about injuries, but I wasn't too worried about Son as soon as the injury was announced.
Yeah, nor was I. I kept him in my fantasy team, and I'm very glad of that.
Yes.
So we had a question from Ram on our X-Subs Discord channel. He says, were we great, United terrible, or a combination, or something else? So rather than go through first half, second half, let's just get that over and done with first. What do you reckon, Bardi?
Well, I think it was a bit of both. I think they didn't press our weaknesses. Aurier, we know he's not great defensively. We know Sissoko's not too great on the ball. I'd like to think that we were great and we punished them and we were very smart and we were very quick and we were very strong. And there was a sharpness to our play, which sometimes you forget that was what our fourth game in 8 days. It didn't look like that the way they run around the pitch.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add, Nathan?
Yeah. There was a comment from Gary Neville who was like, he was going off on one as like a United fan in the second half.
He was devastated.
He was devastated. He was audibly, professionally devastated on air for an hour and a half plus. And there was a bit where he said the red card had no impact on this game, and I laughed out loud because that is literally absurd. Of course the red card had a massive impact on this game, but what you can say is that doesn't guarantee a victory for the team with 11 men, but we absolutely pushed that advantage home. We absolutely took control of that game in every facet, and equally United completely fell apart as a result of the red card as well.
I mean, Man United got a penalty within 30 seconds. And after the game, Harry Kane spoke a lot about mindset and stuff like that. And it's something that we've spoken about, the lack of maybe a psychologist within the ranks. And some Spurs teams at Old Trafford have crumbled for less than that, but we didn't. And we scored virtually immediately after, and we ended up being 2-1 up while they still had 11 guys on the pitch. And I think a lot of credit's got to go to the players and the management for that we didn't allow that to affect our game. And in fact, we all just joke that Man United were going to get a penalty. It actually worked out for our advantage that he got it in the first 30 seconds, so at least it was over and done with, without getting it around the 43rd minute or something like that. It did kind of open the game and force us to come out a bit.
So in the documentary, Mourinho talks a lot about coping with adversity. That's one of his many things that he is almost like a mantra to him. We cope with this. We cope with the pressure. We deal with this. And I'll tell you what, one team coped with that admirably and the other team absolutely crumbled. I mean, I understand completely why Neville was so upset because, I mean, certainly after the third goal, it did look like United weren't trying anymore, to be honest. It looked that bad. Heads dropped. And they were a complete and utter shambles, embarrassment. I thought that was really noticeable. But like Bardi says, we smelt blood. And we honed in on every possible weakness. We created overloads. We did all the things that you should do to put a team like that to the sword, to put them to bed, to kill the game off. And we did it over and over and over again. And one of my criticisms under Pochettino was sometimes that we'd get two or three goals ahead and then we'd stop and we'd conserve energy. This was the opposite. This was like, we might need these goals. We might need this goal difference later in the season at some point. Let's hammer home this advantage and let's just go and go and go. And don't stop until, you know, we've absolutely curb stomped them. Some of United's defending was utterly comical in this game. The first goal, obviously Lamela makes a complete nuisance of himself, and it's wonderful to just focus on Lamela when you watch the replay. Even more wonderful is to focus on Harry Maguire, because he makes about four or five mistakes in that same incident. It's insane how bad he is. And Ndombele obviously sticks that away. And then we see a wonderful bit of quick thinking from Kane for the second, right? That was an amazing ingenuity to get the ball down, place it up for the free kick, play it quick. But United have switched off. They let him do that. I mean, it's schoolboy stuff to allow that to be taken that early. And even though another thing I'd say on that goal, Son's touch is a little bit heavy. If you rewatch it, it's not the best touch. But De Gea is so slow off his line. If that's Lloris, I guarantee you he comes out when he picks up that ball at Son's feet. But De Gea was massively at fault. Third goal, Eric Bailly's failing to play out from the back. Fourth goal, Sissoko's got seconds and seconds to play the ball out to Aurier. Fifth goal, Højbjerg has the same, masses of time to pick out Aurier. And the sixth, you've got Ben Davis making Paul Pogba look like an absolute moron in the box. So awful, awful defending from United, but brilliance from Spurs.
Absolutely, absolutely. You spoke to sort of smelling blood, and I think that's really who we are now. Like being lethal with whatever we have. Like one chance to counter against Newcastle, it's a goal. Chance to take a quick free kick by Harry Kane, he spots it. Son is alive to it, and straight away, and we're just clinical in those kind of ways. And look, I still think that we're not always going to play brilliantly. We're not always going to have the upper hand. But when we do, whenever we do, we're just going to always push that advantage home now. That's who we are.
I think we would have taken a lot from that Newcastle game as well, where we had that advantage. We had so many opportunities and we weren't ruthless in that game, and it came back to hurt us. Penalties are so easy now that you need to be clear. And I think that Newcastle game, even though it was 2 points dropped, I think it's going to help us in the long run. It could be a defining moment where we just learn to be bad bastards and just kill teams.
Speaking of penalties, Kane, like, he's been very good for a long time, but his penalty taking is just absurd now. Like a cannon into the side netting. There's nothing. It's a goal. Like when Kane sets up to take a penalty, we're not talking about is he going to score, is he not going to score. We're talking, I think he's going to go bottom left. No, he went bottom left last time. I think he's going to go middle. Yeah, but is he going to go middle high or middle low? You know,
you said exactly what I was about to say, because it's not just the power, the precision. It's the fact that he changes it up every time. Yeah. That's what makes him such an elite penalty taker.
It's 13 from 13 for him now in the Premier League. He used to have bottom left was always his kind of favourite. Yeah. And then in high stress situations, he used to go straight down the middle, but he got found out. And I think that was the last penalty he missed. It was against Karius at Liverpool away. And since then, he's just become... I mean, penalties are so common now that you need to practice that all the time. And he's definitely one of the best out there at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about Kane. The form he's in at the moment... I said in our WhatsApp group yesterday, I think it's maybe the greatest form I've ever seen Kane in. And I really mean that as well. Not just in terms of you know, his goals, which are fantastic, his assists, which are great, but his all-round game is just perfection. He rarely makes mistakes. He's so driven. And as much as I was critical of Mourinho's approach in the documentary to management of lots of the players, one thing I think we all picked up on was how Kane absolutely seemed to take on board everything Mourinho was saying. And I think, honestly, I think it's worked. I think the approach he's taken with Kane has been spot on. I really believe that. Kane sees Mourinho as someone who can take him to the next level and can potentially win him something and can make him, you know, truly elite. And Nathan, I remember you joked that Mourinho sort of meant it as a cult of celebrity type thing, and yeah, Kane didn't quite get that. Kane was focused on the football side. Either way, it doesn't matter. It's worked a treat.
They've arrived.
It literally doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's so much more to say.
Yeah, I agree. We could just talk an hour for Kane. I think we're now approaching November, and Kane in November always makes me nervous. I don't know whether he's got a history of getting injured in November, but I just want to get through the next month or so without any drama to Kane's ankles. And I wish England weren't playing. I wish he wasn't going on international duty. But I always get nervous now, especially when he's so good like he is at the moment.
So Nathan already mentioned Aurier having a really strong game, and I think that he deserves a lot of credit and deserves us to spend some time dwelling on that a little, because he's someone we've been regularly critical of, and I think for good reason. I think it's been justified. This was, in my view, his best ever Spurs performance. And I don't mean that in terms of his defending, which I thought was pretty steady, although he was largely untested. I don't mean that in terms of the fact that he was always there as an outlet on the right, which he was, but he's often an outlet on the right and has been really useful. For me, the difference here was that he didn't just swing in crosses and hope for the best. He was really precise. He really took his time. And actually, I saw a bit of Matt Doherty in his decision-making and his arriving in the box. You know, the diagonal run into the box for his goal was very Matt Doherty, and I liked what I saw there. I don't know if that's like a thing that we're training now because we've got Doherty there, or whether he's just seen the way Doherty plays and he's been involved in video playback. I don't know, but it worked a treat.
That is a feature of his game historically, and he has scored a couple for us from that position. But maybe that's an enhanced thing. Maybe that's something that we want to do as a team now, and so he's invited to do that even more. He scored was it against Palace doing that, and another game as well. And he has a nice finish in that position as well. He tucks the bottom far post from there every time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael Cox wrote an interesting piece for our friends at The Athletic, and it was talking about how good players they come into a club. So Man United signed Bruno Fernandes, and he came in and he was amazing, but then he kind of dropped to the rest of the players. He dropped to the same level as the rest of the players around him, whereas we've put in someone like Doherty, and maybe this has had an impact on Aurier, who's had to raise his game up to Doherty's standard, and Davies has had to raise his standard up. And he signed off his little piece by saying buying good players helps, but unless they're playing under a good manager, they won't remain good for very long. And I think that's maybe what we're seeing now. I mean, it's really, really early. It's one Serge Aurier performance. But perhaps by increasing the level of players around him, all of a sudden we're getting a much better Serge, perhaps.
Sure. I mean, it's transfer deadline today, and I would still be happy for us to sell Serge Aurier if a good bid came in, simply because we're going to need the money at some point, and he's at a point now in his career and his age profile where we probably aren't going to get this good a fee for him again. So I take it, but he really honestly put in a superb performance, and not his first this week. I'd say he also played really well in his previous match, and the signs are really good. Any other players you'd like to dwell on? Højbjerg got lots of mentions on Match of the Day. He was really steady, really, really good. He held our midfield together. Equally, Manu's midfield was pathetic and just essentially didn't put any pressure on the ball when we had it, which is a huge mistake when you're up against a player as classy as Ndombele and a player as incisive when given time as Højbjerg. What did you think, Nathan?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the Bruno Fernandes thing that the body points out, he is, and this is something that I was sort of concerned about, he is making a bit of a step up from the level that he was at Southampton, which is still a good level. Like, he was always going to be a good player if he came here. But I think he's you know, he's looking good plus at the moment.
And interestingly, he played deepest lying.
Yes.
Which is, I think, something we all want to see going forward.
I think Reguilón deserves... deserves a little a nod to him as well. Shaw was awful, and then you kind of compare the two left backs, and Reguilón was just superb going forward, defending. His movement across the pitch, his ability to recover as well. I thought he was great. Lamela changed the game, but I still don't think he had the greatest game. He changed the game by being very Eric Lamela, but he also caused us a few problems by being very Eric Lamela, by allowing Man United to counter us. I still think he needs to release the ball a bit better, because he does get us caught, and sometimes I think his decision making in the final third can, especially when we've committed players to an attack, can cause us issues against a better team. So as much as the win is down to in little part to him, I still think we need to see a little bit more from him, and I won't be too upset to see him out of the starting lineup.
I think the win is a lot down to Lamela. Nathan, do you think Lamela should have been sent off?
Yeah, probably. I mean, so we have this rule where you can push and shove and kick out at each other, but if you lightly brush another player's face, you have crossed this completely arbitrary line where that's completely inexcusable. And, okay, every single player going into the match knows that, has experienced that, is practiced that, is aware of that. So they're going in with an equal understanding of that being the case, but it's so completely arbitrary that why is like an elbow in the throat not as bad as a slap around the face or whatever?
I mean, it's so much worse. It's so much more painful.
I think it's worse, yeah. but that's where we draw the line, apparently.
Yeah, it's mad. Not the face. It's crazy. It's really crazy. What did you think of his reaction to the little brush of his cheek, Bardi, his having to bend over and gather his thoughts for a moment?
We now go live to our Latin correspondent.
I really got offended by that comment. I don't get offended easily, but I was just like, what are you even talking about? And then he starts bringing Italy into the equation. I've worked in a Latin country, because he's also managed in Portugal as well. And I'm just like, what are you doing? You're just stereotyping, not just continents, countries, everybody. And I thought it was ridiculous. Lamela didn't come out of that too well, but he got hit in the face. And we've seen it before. Any player that gets hit in the face will use that as an advantage. Martial shouldn't have done it. Lamela shouldn't have done it. Lamela was a bit smarter than Martial there. And that's what Mourinho wants from our players. He wants them to be smarter.
Certainly, you could just give Lamela a straight red for the elbow, but even more, you can give him a yellow for the elbow and then a second yellow for the theatrics. Just because he was fouled doesn't mean that he should, you know, do a 10-minute performance on the floor.
So yeah, absolutely. And this is another reason why VAR is flawed, because as I've said many times, it stops referees making decisions because they think it's okay, VAR pick it up, and then you get to a point where it's actually two yellows, arguably, and VAR does nothing because it doesn't have the authority to do anything, so you end up with worse decisions as a result.
I mean, I put in the running order our referees' decisions being impacted by the lack of a crowd there, and I think I don't think that referee has the guts to send off Martial in front of that. Is that the Stretford end?
Might have been.
I don't think he does it. I think he gives yellow and tells them both to grow up. But then I thought Shaw's tackle was a red card, and perhaps had Martial not already been sent off, he would have sent Shaw off there. So I think the crowd does play a part. And I also think, say Man United losing 2-1, well, they were losing 2-1, so we don't need to imagine it, but Man United losing 2-1, they go down to 10 men. That crowd, due to the injustice, their perceived injustice of Martial being sent off, all of a sudden has the possibility to galvanise that football team. And perhaps that has a knock-on impact. Whereas it's silent, Solskjaer, we know he's not the most vocal on the sideline, his inability to galvanise his team and they fall apart. I think the crowd, a lack of crowd, is having a huge impact on the moment of football.
It's a good point. I think it's a really good point. We have a question from Greenman RD from our Discord channel. He says, I'm curious what Windy thinks, since he picked us to finish fifth or sixth, if I recall correctly. How do our recent performances change your feelings about us finishing top four? It's a really good time, I think, to check in. I made that prediction before the Bale and Reguilón signings, and I might need to revise that. So this is where I think we are at the moment. I think Mourinho has been backed like Pochettino arguably wasn't, for whatever reason. Be that, you know, the stadium money is coming in now, and it wasn't there before, maybe. maybe Mourinho is simply more flexible on player signings, which I think is a very viable argument. Like, we knew Pochettino turned down Tielemans. We knew he turned down Pereira, for example. I think it's completely realistic to say that Mourinho is a bit more pragmatic and just wants upgrades in. Or maybe Daniel Levy has belatedly accepted that a complete squad refresh was required. I don't know. It's whatever reason, it's worked out this way. So here's what I think. I think we have the second or third best goalkeeper in the league. I think we have a very good right back, although I wouldn't want to rank him because the number of outstanding right backs around is utterly outrageous at the moment. I think we have a top three centre-back in the league in Alderweireld. I'm a bit concerned he's not in the team at the moment, but I think he's great. At one point, I think he was the best. He's definitely getting worse, but I still think he's good, really good. I think we have a slight weakness alongside Alderweireld, but I do think Tanganga has fantastic potential and potentially could become the best centre-back at the club. I think we've got the second best left back in the league after Andy Robertson. I think we've got the second best midfielder in the league in Ndombele after De Bruyne. I think we've got another outstanding central midfielder in Lo Celso, very solid, dependable leader in a defensive midfielder in Højbjerg. I think we've got a top three left wing forward in Son, along with Mane and Sterling. I think we've got potentially one of the best right wing forwards in Bale, although it is obviously a question mark over his fitness. And I think we've got the best striker in the league in Kane.
No doubt.
So, you know, we're pretty well set now, right? I think overall, we have got the second best team in the league after Liverpool.
And a good squad too.
And a good squad. And people will say, look, City have a really good team and a better squad. And I would definitely say that Sterling and De Bruyne would probably be in our top three best players, right? Don't get me wrong, I think City are terrific. I think we're more balanced. I think our players are more integrated. I think Chelsea have some fantastic players, but we're more settled and they're going to take some time to click into gear. So now it's up to Mourinho. I mean, the purpose of a coach, in my opinion, is to create a team, a unit, a structure, a system that's greater than the sum of its parts. And we saw that under Pochettino for many, many, many years. If Mourinho's as good as he used to be and as good as he believes he still is, we should be pushing for the league title with this team within the next 2 years. And the absolute bare minimum this year should be top four, right? And I think we can realistically expect second or third this season. And I, so far, so good. You know, the Europa League campaign is going really well. The first match wasn't the best, but it has been going really well. The match against Chelsea was terrific. I think these early games, although they've been a hindrance in terms of fitness concerns, it's allowed us to build form and fitness. And one of the most important things in football, in my eyes, momentum, which other teams simply don't have. So we're in a really, really, really good place right now. My thoughts are that this is not going to last all season. Right. I do believe that we'll have our ups and downs. And so the question will be, can we grind our way through those downs and do enough to finish top four, to finish top two, to win the league? It's very open this year. There's so many good teams and they're all taking points off each other. I'm feeling pretty optimistic about how things are going on the pitch right now. And I think Mourinho's doing an excellent job.
You said a really interesting thing there a couple of minutes ago for me about Pochettino made the team better than the sum of its parts. And I think that fundamentally, my long, long-term issue with Mourinho is that he no longer does that. But you also pointed out the strength of this team and the strength of this squad. And I think that if Mourinho can create something that is equal to the sum of its part, well, that's a hell of a team and that's a hell of a squad. And more importantly, what I've been saying is, I think Mourinho is doing a decent job. I think we can get top four, but there's surely no way that we can catch this incredible top two. Pan over to what's happening at Liverpool and City right this absolute second. I wouldn't want to rule out the possibility of us challenging for title this season.
Oh, well, look at you guys. Welcome up to my little Jose Mourinho hill.
It's warm here.
It's nice up here. It's nice view. I was always under the impression that we would finish there or thereabouts in the top four. I think the signings we've made have been really good. I think in situations when form drops and we're in sticky parts, I think we've got enough kind of like leaders, for want of a better word, lack of a better word, who can pull games out of the hat. Bale is a player that could just whack one in from anywhere. Kane can do a bit of magic. I think we've got magic in individuals who can get results on their own. I think we've got the building of a team that can do things as a team. So I'm quietly confident. What I do kind of like is, so far we've seemed to be pretty defensively sound. Whereas the other teams, they don't look it. I think that's where our advantage lies at the moment, in a kind of reasonably settled back four and a settled goalkeeper. We're not shipping goals and we're not shipping the chances. And at the moment, everybody who plays a high line is getting exposed. Arsenal should have had a player sent off at the weekend for trying to play a high line. Liverpool's high line was looked bad against Arsenal, and then last night was insanely bad. So I'm confident in our ability to sit deep when we need to and play a high line when we've got to do that, and our tactical flexibility, which is why I think what I'm most impressed now with Jose is his ability to press high or sit deep or do a medium block, and our ability to change through those formations over 90 minutes. That's what I've been most impressed with under him.
So do you want to hear my little theory on why the high lines are being so exposed?
Ooh.
Yeah. Go on. So high lines are great. Liverpool won the league last year comfortably at a canter with a high line. What you need to make a high line work is immense pressure on the ball from multiple angles. And that requires one, fitness, and two, organisation. And in order to build fitness and build organisation, you require a sustained period of time on the training ground, which hasn't happened because there's been no pre-season. So I think teams like Hasenhüttl, Southampton, Klopp's Liverpool are going to come unstuck until they find their fitness, find their organisation, and get used to the intensity that the teams are playing at right now. I think also because, like, for example, Everton have gone from being, you know, a plodding middle of the road team to suddenly having genuine X factors sprinkled amongst that 11. Leicester, although they've got a lot of injuries right now, they have some phenomenal players in their team. They're really, really good teams that can punish mistakes, punish any weaknesses. And I think that's what we're seeing. Villa, you know, Aston Villa were relegation candidates last season. Suddenly they've got a midfield with Ross Barkley and Jack Grealish feeding a phenomenal young striker in Ollie Watkins. They didn't have that last year. He's all right, isn't he? We got a few mentions I saw about that in the extra inch account name. So that's my theory. I do think the high line thing and the pressing thing won't be so much of an issue later in the season. But we're actually able to capitalize that on that right now because we don't use a high line, we don't use a pressing system. So it's worked out in our favour.
Maybe those two teams with the high line are cycling off something for this season. And that's maybe why they can't sustain the pressure. Maybe there's too much asthma going around. They can't cope with it this year.
Delivery issues under the pandemic, eh?
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that one.
Love it. Love it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Guys, do we want to do anything about Maccabi Haifa? I mean, it was an absolute smashing of another fairly average team. I'd say they were a little hard done by. They didn't look too bad. They were just terrible defensively. Is that fair?
Tell us what Mourinho said.
He said the game was a bit strange. Normally to score 7 goals is impressive, but I don't think the performance was impressive. It was clinical and we hurt them many, many times in transitions. They were adventurous. They risked a lot and tried to play the way they normally play in every match in their league. I don't think they feared us and they were punished badly with 7 goals.
I agree.
This is what happens, though. You can't, if you're going to play this Tottenham team, you have to come with a plan, which isn't just, I want to play my style. Southampton tried it, got banged. Man United tried it, got banged. Maccabi Haifa, poor little guys. I admire their guts to attempt it, but 7 goals got shipped. You have to be a bit smarter against our forwards. This game was one of the reasons why I've been pro Europa League, because matches build, like you guys said, confidence builds momentum. It allows minutes on the pitch for players who wouldn't get minutes. Ndombele came on against Plovdiv and changed the game, and those are minutes that he wouldn't have got otherwise. So I'm very pro Europa League. Now we're getting into the group stage. I think our group draw is pretty nice. There's no massive kind of commutes across Europe or anything else like that. So I'm very pro Europa League, and you know, it would look great alongside the other 3 trophies we're going to collect this year.
They literally chatted shit and got banged. We're going to do a section now about American Spurs fans, and I think this might be the start of a longer conversation, to be honest, because there's so much to say. And to give you some background, this sort of spawned from the conversation we were having about disengagement. We got loads of emails, correspondence from American fans. This one stood out to me. So this is from Chris Klein from Las Vegas. He said, "Our American fans of the club looked at differently by diehard British supporters who've been to tons of matches and supported the club all their lives. Would I be looked at as something else altogether, like a niche thing over on the other side? Or are American fans who support the club fully accepted, even if how we came to support Spurs is a little less organic?" I had this from Andrew Felder. He said, "As an American, I've come to learn that Europeans experience their sports fandom very differently from here in America. American sports fans are just as passionate, but I think we follow our teams as external observers, whereas your committed Premier League fans seem to genuinely feel like their club is a personal extension of their own lives. In the US, it's our team, but for you, it's almost like it's part of the family. The club is something we observe, and there's no pretensions beyond that. Second, as a Spurs fan who joined the ranks about 5 or 6 years ago, I've probably not received proper training in whatever Spurs' values are that you feel Mourinho represents a violation of. I don't feel his presence violates any sacred trust. I respect that your feelings may be more typical than mine, but I just wanted to share how it feels to a newer generation in recency, not age, of fan. I want trophies and an exciting style of play. I'm able to get behind any coach who can provide that." And equally, we had this from Andrew Smith. He said, "In America, there is simply nothing like the enormous allure of English football, the connection to the community and the semi-tribal nature of the support. The feeling when standing in the Park Lane during our 3-1 dismantling of Manchester United during peak Pochettino was absolutely euphoric to someone raised on corporo glossy American sports." So many interesting comments there, and I just thought it was deserving of a wider conversation, which might open up something else. Anything come to mind immediately, Nathan, in response to those comments?
Yeah, I feel like the comment about sort of Spurs values, not having the requisite sort of indoctrination into that sort of mindset, into growing up, to going to the stadium as a kid and those kind of experiences to learning. And I think that we don't know how much we know, that because we've not, you know, you don't sit down and do a test, but you are drip fed the culture of the club over years and years and years and years, and you experience it firsthand, and you know hundreds of thousands of fans, and you feel the club. And I think that, yes, geographic distance is a factor, but it's the values thing, and that is probably what a lot of English fans have an issue with non-English fans of their club, is not you can't love Tottenham like I do because you're not here, but it's because you haven't had the necessary experience. You aren't Tottenham because you don't know Tottenham like I do. But I think that a different attachment to the club that is just as sincere is also completely real, and you don't have to know about the bloke who yells selling burgers outside the stadium to have a deep connection to Eric Lamella. If you're, you know, again, I've talked about this before, getting up at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning to go to a bar to watch Spurs with a bunch of other American Spurs fans, and you are creating your own culture with your own group of people around the same club, then we're still all Tottenham fans.
Yeah, I agree a lot with what Nathan said. And I'm going to go back to a comment he said before about other people questioning other people's fandom and just how who are these diehard British supporters? Who are they to judge somebody else? Just because somebody hasn't grown up in Tottenham and isn't been told to support Tottenham by generations and generations of family doesn't mean they're less of a fan. I think what sometimes maybe stick in the throat of an English Spurs fan when they hear American Spurs fans is just because they look at the game very differently. American sports are very stat-based and everything else, which some people don't like about English football. They just prefer to watch it with their eyes and they don't get on with XG and everything else. So there is that kind of clash of cultures. But football now, this sport that we watch is completely changed from what it was in 1990 before the Premier League even existed. It's a completely different sport and it appeals to completely different fans. We have fans who follow Mourinho. We have fans who follow an individual player who come along and they become a Tottenham fan. Is a fan of Mourinho who supports Tottenham solely because of Mourinho? Is he less of a fan than somebody else? Am I more of a fan than Windy, who's like number one laptop fan? It's like, you know, who am I to judge? Who are any of us to judge each other? I just think it's just the whole thing that they're American and they sound different and certain pockets of Tottenham support get upset by that. But then that's just not them getting upset by Americans being different. That's them getting, they get upset by lots of people who are different to them. So that's their own kind of maybe gammon that's coming out. I welcome American fans. I've hung out with American fans in New York, the New York Spurs, and they're great. And we all support Tottenham. And there's bigger things that we can all get worked up about than how someone sounds who supports the same club as you. But I agree with you. I would love to go into this in a bit more detail to see about the kind of culture that's being created out there and everything else like that. We had a really good chat with Wheeler Dealer Radio, who see things differently to us. And we all agree on the same principles, the same core principles of Tottenham doing well.
Absolutely. I mean, so I'm nothing if not honest. So let me share my feelings and be a bad bastard temporarily. About 8 years ago, something like that, I did have a problem with American Spurs fans. I'm not going to lie. And it wasn't because of them. It was because of Spurs, right? So Spurs made this very sudden, very crude, very obvious cash grab in the States. They really went big on the American audience. And it came as a bit of a shock to me. And I was very naive about the sort of potential of new markets and such like. It just wasn't something I thought about regularly. You know, Spurs are my club. It was a community at that point for me. And suddenly they were going on these pre-season tours to the States where it actually put the start of the season at risk because it was happening so close to the season. And frankly, I wasn't going to get to see the new signing make his first Spurs appearance against Leyton Orient or Stevenage or a team where you're literally like 5 yards away. But some American Spurs fans were going to get a meet and greet with our new signing instead. And I was a little bit bitter and twisted about that. And then over time, I realised that was a terrible opinion. And these fans who, as Bardi and Nathan point out so eloquently, they make their own huge sacrifices for the love of Tottenham Hotspur. They deserve to see these players in the flesh. They don't get the chance to do that unless they travel hundreds of miles and spend thousands of pounds to do so. So it was the right thing to do commercially, but it was also the right thing to do in terms of the kind of involvement of our wider fan base. So, you know, I realised pretty quickly what was happening. And the more I interacted with some US Spurs fans, the more I appreciated them. And I really enjoyed conversing with them about football because, as Bardi says, they have totally different takes on sport because the way American sport is presented is very, very different to how we have sport presented to us in the UK. And I found that fascinating. I definitely think there are sort of, I want to say, like tiers of fandom that's that informally exist, rightly or wrongly. So obviously the top tier would be the fans that go home and away. They sacrifice their lives to do this. They pay huge money to do so. They accept lesser jobs because they give them more flexibility, you know? They travel to cup matches in Barnsley on a Tuesday night and get back at 3 a.m. on a Wednesday morning. That is a tremendous sacrifice. And then season ticket holders, you know, Barley's a season ticket holder. Okay, fine. He goes to the gym when Spurs are playing Chelsea in a local derby, but he also goes to every home match that he can. He goes to every home match. He makes sacrifices to do that, financial, familial, otherwise. And somewhere down this pecking order, in the eyes of the traditional support, would be the American Spurs fans or the Australian Spurs fans or the Korean Spurs fans or whoever. And I definitely think we need to break down those tiers and barriers now, because it is just different types of fandom. We all support this club in a different way. My way of supporting the club now is not to go to games. I last went to a game over a year ago. I honestly don't really care if I don't go to many more games. It's not what it was to me going to games. But I'll never miss a Spurs match. I'll always, you know, cancel my plans and make myself available to watch Spurs and love watching Spurs from home and talking about it with you guys and with my friends and with my family afterwards. And I don't think that makes me any less of a fan than someone who wants to go every game. It's just that they enjoy that part of it and I don't anymore. And that's cool. It's cool with me, at least. I found this, the emails we got in, really interesting. If people have more thoughts or emails that they want to send us on this subject, please do. And we'll share some of the best ones. podcast@theextrainch.co.uk if you want to email. But yeah, it'd be lovely to hear from more American Spurs fans to get their views, and, you know, more UK-based Spurs fans to hear how they feel about, you know, fans from other countries. Anything else to add, lads?
I would say yes, if you are a foreign fan and you have your own, you know, inter-foreign fan culture, then your fanship is completely, completely valid. But I would also recommend making the effort to sort of absorb the existing local and English otherwise culture around the club. I think that's probably a worthwhile thing to do. And you can miss with that. You can get that wrong and be cringy with it, I'm sure. But I do think it's worth something. You should try out a little bit.
Cool. We're going to do a question before we leave you. This is from Alec Depkrinsky. He says, what's your strongest 11 that the team could field based on the current squad versus what's the strongest 11 that you could honestly see Mourinho deploying based on the current squad? So what do you think is our best team, and what do you think is the best team that Mourinho would be willing to put out, Bardi?
I think it's probably going to be a back four of Reguilón, Dier, and at the moment Davinson and Doherty. I think that would be his back four.
Joe Hart in goal.
the winner in goal. Obviously Lloris in goal, and I think probably Højbjerg. Now this is where the question gets interested. Would he be willing to play Ndombele and Lo Celso at the same time? That's the big question. We don't know, because he hasn't had to face that due to fitness issues. Does he want someone in alongside him? But I think the best 11 would be, I think you guys both agree, Ndombele, Lo Celso alongside Højbjerg, and then Bale, Kane, Son.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty standard. But
the only difference I'd make is I would have Alderweireld in my back four.
Yeah.
And I think by the end of the season, I might have Tanganga in there. But obviously, I think it's a little too early to say that.
He's marked that, made a note of it, and he's going to pull it out in May, saying, I told you guys. Here's the podcast where I said it.
Listen, I think Sanchez and Dier are not bad defenders at all. I don't think they are ever going to be elite. And I think they both had a huge number of chances that would not normally be given to a young homegrown player. So this is where there's a point of interest there. Sanchez, because he costs 40 million, we kind of have to give him opportunity to become worth that again. Whereas I don't think Tanganga gets that. If he plays like Sanchez does week in, week out, they just sell him and move on.
I think the problem we have with Dier, Sanchez and Alderweireld is I don't think individually they're that bad. Well, Dier's pretty shaky, but I don't think they're that bad as individuals. I just don't think they work as a partnership. And I think that's the key problem, is we don't have a centre-back partnership. We have centre-backs, but not two that kind of work off each other in the kind of Jan Vertonghen and Toby Alderweireld kind of style.
I think, as we know, Mourinho likes loud, big characters who are organisers and leaders. Dier is obviously an organiser. He's very vocal. He's got a good understanding of the game and he knows how to line up a defence. I don't think Alderweireld is. I think Alderweireld is quite quiet, quite timid. He leads by example rather than by sort of motivational speeches or shouts to organise people. So that's why I think the preference has happened in terms of Dier over Toby. Nathan, anything you'd add to the strongest 11 versus what you think Mourinho might put out there? I mean, are you going to say that he'd choose Lucas Moura on the right wing?
Yeah, that's you're not wrong. Yeah, Bale at number 10, Lucas on the right. You don't rule it out, guys. That's all I'm saying. I mean, yeah, the question is, could we play Ndombele and Lo Celso at the same time? Yes. Can we play both attacking fullbacks at the same time? Yes. Can we play both Ndombele, Lo Celso and the attacking fullbacks at the same time? Wouldn't rule it. It's a hell of a team. It's a hell of a team if you look at it that way. But I just, it's a little worrying. I wouldn't say it can't be done. And I wouldn't say that Mourinho wouldn't. And we talked about this before when we were about to sign Gareth Bale. It's not past Mourinho to play in a very attacking combination of players. But it invites you to play on the break, which is fine. So I think that you can play those 11 players against, you know, Man United and play on the break, but you would maybe have a hard time dominating the ball with all of those players on the pitch at the same time. Well, you wouldn't have a trouble dominating the ball. You'd have a problem when you lose the ball from a dominating position with those 11.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but maybe it'll be fine anyway.
So what you're saying is he'd be willing to let the handbrake off, but there's a chance we'd roll down the hill.
Nice.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
On the fly.
I'm quite aroused from the idea of Kuibier, Lo Celso, Ndombele, Reguilon and Matt Doherty all being in the same team. That's pretty exciting. Right, should we go and record a QA for our ex-subs, boys?
Let's do it.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud E Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.